I'm Buzz Knight, the host of the Take on a Walk podcast series, and we're here in the delightful suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, a very special place called Burr Ridge, to meet up with a very special dude. He continues to be a major influence to me and others with his critical thinking and his media leadership. Lee Abrams has a resume that would extend for miles along Chicago's Riverwalk. His influence spans across companies like XM Radio, Tribune, ABC Radio, just to name a few. Lee tells it like it is, and I can't wait to take a walk with Lee Abrams.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight.
Well, thanks, Lee. I'm so grateful that you took the time to take a walk with us here in lovely Burr Ridge. This is a pretty cool area of the suburbs.
Yeah, it was south, actually west suburb of Chicago.
So how long have you been out here?
11 years.
It's a nice getaway.
Right? Yeah, it's really nice, and there's a lot of land out here and trees, so it's a nice escape from the city.
Well, that's cool. Well, so I was just thinking, as we were talking about taking a walk, we were conjuring up maybe there's some other little vertical angles of it that I should be pondering, like taking a nap. What do you think of that?
Yeah, great idea. Taking a nap, having a snack. There's a whole series of offshoots you can have.
There's a whole array of them. Well, let's talk about the state of media here, because that's something that you've always been keenly in touch with. Where do you see the state of media today?
Well, generally speaking, I think there's a, it's very corporate, and, you know, that's not necessarily bad, but it does come at the expense of extreme creative. I think particularly in radio and television news, which are, of course, two areas I'm really interested in, there's just a tendency to be working off a playbook that's 30 and 40 years old at a time when we're going through massive cultural, social, and technological change. And as a result, it's not really in sync with the current day mainstream. And, a day doesn't go by when people don't say, radio sucks, or, I can't watch the news anymore. And these are areas, I'm sort of focused on. But I think it's gotten very consolidated at the expense of creative and just new bold ideas that reflect the era we're in. It's it reminds me a lot, I'm old enough, of the late 60s, early 70s, when back then you had Vietnam and the sexual revolution and drug revolution and Nixon and just craziness. I'm sure glad the internet wasn't around then. But we're seeing the same kind of thing today, just different. It's wars in the Ukraine and, racial inequality, Trump versus the left, and, it's a crazy time. And I don't think a lot of media really reflects the electricity that's happening now.
Why are corporate executives of today in media afraid to change?
Well, I think a lot of them are, some of the older ones are just riding it out. And a lot of them just make a lot of money and don't want to blow it. And in the culture, too, it's very, it's not conducive to change. Obviously, when some companies start out, whether it's Amazon or Netflix, they're all about change. But the more traditional companies kind of stuck in their ways. And again, the top executives making a lot of money and don't see the urgency in change. And don't want to risk it, I think is the bottom line.
How much of it do you think has to do with the problem in certainly both radio and in television that there's a measurement system that these businesses, quote unquote, have to play to?
Yeah, I think, a great product will win regardless of the measurement system. I think it's flawed, but, it's always been sort of flawed. I think the great products will prevail regardless of how they're measured.
But the fact that measurement is coming from a monopoly, do you feel that that is of issue?
I really do, personally don't worry about it. Again, I'm more concerned about creating really new, powerful products that are in sync with the age we're in. And I think regardless of who's doing the measurement, it'll all come out in the wash if it's really connecting with the mainstream.
So let's touch on radio first. Radio's position here is greatly challenged, especially music formats, right? Because you can get music anywhere. So what's your opinion on the face of radio as we know it today?
Well, I think, again, on the older end, it seems to be doing okay. People who grew up with the radio and have wonderful experiences with it over the years. Younger end, it's a real problem. I remember when we first started at XM, we asked a lot of older people, 40 and over, what they thought of the concept, and they were like, this is great. I mean, we'll have a jazz station, we'll have this, no commercial, love it. Talked to young people, and they said, why would I pay for radio? Radio sucks. And in digging deeper, they've never experienced the great radio stations. Somebody who was, when we launched XM in 2001, somebody who was 18, never, grew up with those stations that people like you and I did, so there was no reference to what radio could be. So, I think the problem right now is people aren't taking advantage of the radio experience. Streaming is great. I mean, I have all the streaming services and listen to them, but the radio experience done right, where there's magic between the songs, there's intelligent hosts that sort of walk you through the journey, and there's intriguing music mixes, and, the list goes on. That's really powerful, but you don't hear it anymore. At XM, again, using them as an example, we played a lot of tapes and went through the blueprints of really the great stations. That was KLIF in the middle 50s, KHJ in the mid-60s, and KCBQ in the early 70s, etc., and really broke down what made those stations great. And they were a 360-degree experience, everything from the way they looked to their attitude and swagger on the air to their adventure in music to owning the music, the perception that they were their playlist was the Bible of music. And no stations do that anymore, and I think that those characteristics can be reinterpreted for the 21st century. And again, you can't copy what KHJ did, 50 or 60 years ago. But you can take those blueprints and really reimagine them for the realities of the 21st century. And I think that's important. There are going to be some people who they're going to stream, but they're not everybody. I think radio can be a better bigger slice of the pie for a lot of people. Because again, there's a lot of radio sucks, meaning FM radio, and that can be limited, but I don't think stations are trying. At a time when FM radio should be on creative steroids, they're kind of in denial, and again, utilizing a playbook that was written decades ago. There hasn't been a really new format in radio in years, really since the early 70s. There have been just tweaks. You got certain offshoots of classic rock and all that, but something really new, it hasn't been done at a time when it has to be done. And again, I think a lot of it's the corporate environment's not conducive to change. And I understand if somebody's number one and making a lot of money, great. Why change it? But there are a lot of stations that aren't making a lot of money. Those are the ones that I think need to generate whole new ideas, new exciting visions.
One of those things I love that you did at XM was how you flipped upside down the notion of the celebrity guest DJ, and you turned these shows, whether it be the Bob Dylan Theme Time Radio Hour, or what you did with Tom Petty's show, and I'm sure there were others. You flipped that model and elevated it to this degree that is incredible to this day.
Yeah, I mean, those are good examples. Dylan in particular, I mean, just, in talking to him, he was he grew up listening to radio under the covers to those big 50,000 watt stations around the country when he was, you know, growing up in Minnesota, and really saw the romance in radio. And you know, we gave him just really complete creative freedom to recreate that romance on his terms, and it was magical. And not all artists are capable of that. Tom Petty did a great job too. Without mentioning names, there were some people that didn't do real good jobs, but the ones that really got into it and had their own vision of what a radio show could sound like were remarkable.
But you gave them some creative license.
Oh, complete. You know, we gave them guidance, but, you know, as far as the songs they played and what they said, that was all up to them. That was really important. Because, again, I don't think you could format a Bob Dylan. Somebody actually said at XM, not on the air staff, but, you know, what's their clock look like? A clock for Bob Dylan. It's whatever he wants to do.
You must have burst out laughing, right?
Yeah. And there were some people who said, well, he hasn't had a hit in 50 years. It's like, no, you don't understand. He's, you know, the greatest, you know, musical poet of the 20th century. And so we respected him and his wishes and just made it real easy for him and gave him some guidance. At first, they proposed, when we were talking, you know, Bob Dylan channel. And we sort of said, wait, does Bob really have time to program a channel 24/7? 365, maybe an hour or two would be more manageable, and they kind of got that.
Well, to this day, it lives strong.
Yeah.
And like I said, Tom as well, the Petty show, but I love that creativity that was brought to, you know, a fairly, you know, hit or miss scenario with celebrities. We know they could sometimes a rocker would be terrific, and the other times, depending on the moment, it would be like, ugh.
Yeah, I know. We when I was at Z-Rock, we had actually Alice Cooper, Ozzy Osbourne, and Ted Nugent, each doing a two-week trial, and that was interesting. Ted was particularly interesting. You'd get off the air, and he'd have all these policemen in the lobby wanting to take him out and ride. You know, hey, Ted, come with Richardson, Texas police. We're going to bust some, you know, crack houses. And, no, don't go with him. Come with us, Fort Worth guys. We deal with the heavy stuff. And it was unbelievable. And his show was just a little too, I don't know, gun-oriented. Alice Cooper was great. He had great stories, but, you know, I think listeners wanted him to be more of the, you know, the on stage Alice, and he was just a real nice guy.
Yeah.
And Ozzy Osbourne, that didn't last long. He was just, you know, he was Ozzy. That didn't work.
So the state of TV, and specifically the state of TV news, what are you seeing, and then where's your vision for it?
Yeah, TV news, I think information is the new rock and roll, meaning what's really driving culture today is information. And people, you know, have all of it on their phones versus a Walkman. And I think rock and roll, you know, is popular, but looks backwards. It's all about the classic bands and all that. And the newer music, yeah, I think, is more country and hip-hop and super teen pop and all that. But that rock and roll attitude is something that's timeless. It's a certain spirit. So I think, just like radio, worse, TV news is stuck in 1970. You still see two chit-chatting anchors with a fake city skyline behind them. You still hear percussive music. You know, if you close your eyes and listen to a newscast, it's, you know, da-da-da-da-da, tonight at 10. Just bullshit slogans. We believe in you. You know, first action news. It's just, it's comical. And, you know, Simpsons make fun of it. Onion makes fun of it. And it's just stuck. So we're creating something called News Movie, which is really the first news programming ever created by programmers and creatives. Obviously, the place will be just full of journalists. But the actual architecture of it is designed by programming people and creative people. who don't subscribe to the TV news playbook. When I was a Tribune, you know, there were TV stations that had news departments, and God, it was impossible. They were just stuck in the news playbook, couldn't change. And when they did change, I remember going to one station, and they said, you know, we've really changed. We're going to have a tremendous book. We're really modernized everything. I said, wow, that's great. What'd you do? Well, our sports guy now stands up when he gives the scores, and we have a new backdrop, which shows, you know, the new view of the city, and the weather desk. We have a new kind of formica that really is... Is that it? Yeah. Meanwhile, nobody noticed, and ratings came out, and they were still in the toilet. So I'm looking at a complete, radical, dramatic reinvention of television news. And there's three characteristics to it that really define it. One is I, where it's visually stunning. There's no reporter standing in front of a 7-Eleven that was burned down 8 hours ago or robbed, whatever. There's no chit-chatting anchors, no screaming pundits yelling at each other, but just beautiful photography and video. Using multidimensional sources, licensed sources from the APs and the Reuters, just raw footage, no reporters, no graphics or anything. Raw footage, we might use cartoon clips, we might use retro footage, whatever it takes to tell the story. Like a movie. It's not a newscast, it's a news movie, a movie of the world at the moment that's visually striking and devoid of all the cliches, you know, the sets that look like NORAD. It's nonsense. And then ear. That's where every story is elevated because it has a soundtrack. So if it's a story about inner city strife, we might have Coltrane kind of music. If it's a story about tornadoes in Texas, might have Willie Nelson sort of music. So it really elevates the storytelling from just the banal TV news sound, which again, very pompous and percussive, none of that. And thirdly, and probably the most important thing, is brain. Where if you picture an intellectual scale in television, if one is, you know, Honey Boo Boo, some goofy reality show, and 10 is Masterpiece Theater. Most resides in the 3 range. Kind of dumb. And again, people make a lot of money there, and that's fine. News movie will be more like a 7. Never elite, but just not dumb. We call it high IQ, low BS, meaning it's just smarter, and it's totally free of BS. And so it's intelligent. And you put those three things together, visually stunning, sonically deep, and just intelligent. And that's sort of the foundation of the whole thing. And also very honest. Instead of avoiding the tough topics, we'll approach both of them aggressively. If it's gun control, we might have Ted Nugent talking for 60 seconds. And then, I don't know, Barbara Streisand talking for 60 seconds. Literally, you decide. But we're not going to take the vanilla road and avoid those topics. And, you know, if Trump screws up or one of his types, fine, we'll call it out. But same thing with Biden. They screw up. Nobody's immune. So it's very, very honest and real without any political skew. And it's just exciting. It'll have an energy to it. It won't work at the pace of news, which is none of that.
Right.
It's going to talk like real people and just, again, have a modern energy to it. I'm real excited about it. It scares a lot of people, you know, we just got to keep at it and keep pounding and talking to possible partners, because it's not cheap, but we're getting there. We're getting more and more interest all the time, and just going to ride this out till we get it done.
Feels like the time is right for it.
Oh, God.
I mean, really does.
Well, an analogy I use is in 1970, AM radio was the giant in music, but it was becoming, you know, out of sync with the mainstream at that time. FM came along within 5 years, you know, just buried AM musically. And now we see television news where AM was in 1970. It's there, has a big circulation, but it's just so out of touch. So we want to be the to news what FM was to AM.
Well, the look of it from the demo I've seen is spectacular. It's got that energy and that pacing, although in the right way, with the right spirit, the right authenticity.
Yeah.
There's no stopwatch on everything, as I'm sensing.
No, it depends on how long the story needs to be. So it doesn't have that news pacing where, you know, an interesting story, well, we got to wrap it up now. No, it'll go as long as
it needs
to go.
It goes longer.
Yeah. And it'll probably average a minute and a half to 2 minutes a story, some much shorter, some might be longer. But again, it's a movie of the world at the moment, and breaks every rule in the book, and it's where extreme creative meets extreme journalism. And the thing is extreme by today's standards.
So you're optimistic about the... you know, partners and
yeah,
future.
It's tough because we've been at it a while, but we'll get there. There's more and more interest all the time and more evidence of the need for this.
Right.
And there are, without naming companies, there are some companies who look at it, broadcast companies who say, well, we've got our traditional news and it's skewing old. And maybe we could use this to skew young and own it all. Sort of like the old AM and FM thing, where the AM was the big middle-of-the-road station reaching 40-plus, and then the FM was that young hotshot reaching, you know, 18 to 34, 18 to 40. And it's that definitely makes an impact and gets people thinking, yeah, maybe we can own the whole thing rather than hoping our audience doesn't die.
Well, good luck. I know it's going to happen.
Yeah, thank you.
I know it's going to happen.
Thank you.
So... tell me about the documentary you're working on.
Yeah, it's called Sonic Messengers. It is the it's the history of sort of pop culture from World War II to today, told through the filter of radio and music. And it goes from the early R&B artists and those early R&B stations through the top 40 in the 60s and Beatlemania and FM Underground in the late 60s and AOR and disco and everything else, all the way up to streaming and satellites. And but it's not going to be really for radio people only. As a matter of fact, the host, one of the hosts we've signed is John Cleese.
That's great.
Yeah. So,
outstanding.
You know, one of his angles is, well, you know, maybe if he does this, his, you know, real dry English take, as in, what's with these Americans, their infatuation with radio and music, and, you know, listening in their car, what is it with these Americans? And I think that'll be an interesting angle. And we were sort of set back by COVID, but we're again, we've got John on Cleese on board, and we're sort of full guns ahead. And I'm working with a guy named Spencer Proffer, who you may know, who is
Chasing Train, right? Wasn't he part of that documentary?
Yes, he did that one.
Yeah, terrific documentary.
Yeah, he's great and has tremendous experience in negotiating these deals and the actual nuts and bolts of the production. And he's my partner in that, 50-50. And we're charging ahead.
That's great.
Probably be out, hopefully, toward the end of next year, I guess.
Will there be other hosts besides John?
Yes, there will. And we haven't decided who yet.
Yep.
I mean, we've reached out to some people who, like Springsteen, who, no, he doesn't have time. But we'll get the proper hosts in there. Probably somebody a bit younger and a bit more current. But John, he's timeless, but we'll probably have another
perfect
one or two.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
And you had a residency project with Alan Parsons that you
Yes,
work
we're
on.
Working on that, and... that's going great. That'll debut next year, and it's a immersive experience, similar to the Van Gogh experience, except musically focused and much trippier. It's going to be really trippy and very heady and cerebral, and it's again music oriented. And working with Alan Parsons, a guy named Danny Zalisco, who's a big concert promoter, and Dean Ignator, who's a works with Frankie Valli. And it's a great team, because those guys particularly have the venue experience and ticketing and cost controls and all that, as well as being very creative. And Alan, you know, is just a musical god, and with his sound, it'll be a real, you know, audio-visual tour de force.
Will it be Vegas first?
No, we were originally going to do Vegas, but now we decided to do it, probably be Los Angeles first, but because it's an installation, we can have 50 of them all around the country. And it was originally a live show. That got too complicated, and Vegas became too crowded. We couldn't find the right venue. With COVID, all the acts were backed up. You know, the Barry Manilows and all these characters were had put a whole year on hold, so now they're filling it in. So yeah. Finding a place was hard.
Yeah.
But we decided, let's do multiple venues, particularly after seeing the success of Van Gogh. We think this can have the same kind of thing going.
That's great.
Yeah.
So next, you're feeling next year?
Yeah, I think next, hopefully next spring, maybe summer, but next year sometime.
How do you stay so certain with projects that they're going to hit the finish line?
Well, I think...
What's the secret?
I think really thinking them through and in a lot of cases finding the right people to work on it with. And just staying really focused and committed to it and not giving up and just keeping at it.
Just being, just head down.
Yeah. It was the same thing with really going way back, you know, AOR. Because I was 18 at the time, and, you know, it was hard to get people to take you seriously with this new format. But really just hung in there, and the breaks came, and were able to prove it. And then, you know, the floodgates opened. So I expect that'll happen with these projects, too. You know, some challenges, but once it catches on, it's all over.
First concert you ever went to?
The first concert I ever went to was... Cream and open the act was Frank Zappa and the Mothers in 1967.
Where was that?
It was at Chicago. God, what was it called? It's not there anywhere. I think it was called the Auditorium. Not the Auditorium. Anyways, on the south side of Chicago. And it was a relatively small kind of hole in the wall. And that was great. And yeah, and I saw Cream a lot, and The Who a lot back then, and then Canned Heat and all these other crazy bands.
Who do you put concert experience-wise for you, like, at the pinnacle?
For me, it's Yes in the 1973 to 1975 era, when they were just really at their peak. Again, I love that kind of music, but they performed so well with such brilliant arrangements and playing and crystal clear sound, and it was magical. And there's one particular gig which got 110,000 people at JFK Stadium in Philly. I think it was about 75 or 76. And let's see, it was Peter Frampton opened, Gary Wright, the Poussette Dart Band, and then Yes at the end. That was, and they played, you know, and it was a full moon and it was night, and there were, you know, again, 110,000 people, and they just echoed through the JFK Stadium outdoor, and it was like, wow, it was life-changing.
You know, thinking about a lot of those concert bills, how Bill Graham used to book concerts with a very eclectic mix of artists, I don't think you could do that today where promoters couldn't take that risk. Do you agree?
You know, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, there's the big festivals, you know, the Coachellas and all that.
Which do that, you're right. Yeah,
yeah. And so the huge festivals, and then the small ones, one artist, maybe two. You don't see that middle ground where there's six artists like you did with, you know, Bill Graham.
And they were eclectic at times. And
oh, yeah.
Of course, the light show. And
yeah, yeah. It'd be like, and they were big in England, did a lot of that, too. And it would be like Canned Heat, Pink Floyd, The Who, I don't know, a couple other sort of acts that were breaking. And it would be kind of cool.
Yeah. It was
make a night of it.
True experience.
Yeah, and it would be like $5.
Think of that.
Yeah.
So, in closing, I want to get your reaction to what you've learned from musicians over the years and how musicians and bands, you know, whether it be Yes or other examples, what can media companies, other types of companies, learn about the creative process from the way musicians have created over the years?
Yeah, I think the great musicians have their roots firmly in a certain style, but are able to take that and evolve it. And, and Yes, for example, which again I'm close to, you had guys with classical backgrounds, you had guys with blues backgrounds, but they were able to take what they learned as a foundation and just evolve. And that's why I think media companies need to look at their products, like news, and evolve. And it's that rock and roll mentality again, which is striving to be innovative. It's just part of their mission. Going way back, I remember bands in the late 60s, one band would do 8-track, well, the next one would have to do 16-track. One band would have some so-and-so amps, next band had Marshalls. They had to have, it was like an arms race among equipment and technology. And I think media needs that same kind of competitive, striving for innovation, and just a natural ability to be mass appeal without trying. Again, using Yes, Roundabout, the last thing they thought would ever happen would be a hit single, but it happened. And I think when people try too hard, it gets kind of hokey. So these great bands just did what they did to a real high standard and let the public be exposed to it and come to their own conclusions. The rock and roll thinking, other than the striving for innovation, the fact that it's mass appeal, but not by really trying, but just by creating something that is. And let's see, there's about 20 points. I'm just trying to think of some good ones. Motivation to be different, not settling for what somebody else has already done. That's important, really. Like, well, that's been done. We got to do it this way. And so I think I'll send you the rock and roll thinking sort of manifesto. There's about 20 points in there that all could be applied to media companies that really come from the artistic community.
Yeah, and the authenticity of voice.
Oh, authenticity. Yeah, again, you can't fake it. You either got, it's called the it factor. You got it or you don't.
Yeah.
And those who fake it don't get caught.
Well, I said last question, but I have one more.
Sure.
Who inspires you today?
I look at a lot of the innovators, Elon Musk, even though he's got some political issues these days, but I mean, the guy's done some pretty amazing things. And people, at Amazon and Apple and those kind of, not necessarily the people, the companies, mm-hmm. They really create mass appeal intelligence, meaning the products they create are very mass appeal, but they're also intelligent. And somebody actually asked me, give me an example of that. And Apple's great. Everybody's got an Apple product. So it's mass appeal, but they're also really smart, the way they're designed and the way they perform. And, even SpaceX and that whole program, it's mass appeal. Everybody wants to know, are we going to Mars? But it's intelligent, obviously. So I look for mass appeal intelligence in people and in companies.
Thanks for always giving me inspiration to this day.
All right.
Inspiration.
I appreciate that.
So I appreciate you taking a walk in lovely Chicago suburbs here.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks.
Great.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.